Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The markets go up, the markets go down. And if you can't take some pretty wild fluctuations in stock price, you probably shouldn't have your money there. But 600 points in just a few minutes? It happened a year ago. And yes, it could happen again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Cinco de Mayo Thursday. It is the fifth day of May. 1 year ago tomorrow, May 6th to be exact, the Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged hundreds of points in minutes, and within half an hour, nearly 1,000. It was the biggest one-day point decline in history and became known as the flash crash. It was only a flash because before the day was through, the market recovered nearly all its losses. For months, regulators struggled to explain what had happened and why. We know now that the slide was caused by several factors, but primarily by one trade worth billions of dollars that set off a computerized cascade of sell orders. What's been done to fix what ailed the trading floors that day? Mary Shapiro is chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and she joins us from her Washington office. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's get right to the question, I think, on many investors' minds, which is, can this happen again?
Well, let me say that while we can never say it can never happen again, we do think we've taken steps that really address the issues that were raised. So, for example, by putting in place circuit breakers that stop a stock from trading if its price moves more than 10% in 5 minutes, we've eliminated the ability of stock prices to cascade down the way they did on May 6th of last year. We've eliminated the ability for stocks to be traded at what we call stub quotes or penny prices. And we continue to work on additional initiatives to try to bolster the resiliency of the market. So I think as a result of our actions, we have significantly reduced the likelihood of a similar event ever occurring again.
You mentioned the circuit breakers, and I know that recently one of the fixes that's been explored is something called a limit up, limit down rule. What is that and how is that different?
That's exactly right. What limit up and limit down does, it really becomes a precursor to the pause in the marketplace that the circuit breaker gives us. And so what it would do would be to prevent an order from even being entered into the market at a price too far away from the actual market price of the stock, so that we wouldn't have the possibility for erroneous trades to begin a market's rapid decline the way we saw on May 6th. Not that the May 6th events were an erroneous trade, but that's certainly still a possibility.
You know, part of what made the flash crash so worrisome for a lot of investors is that it took a long time for regulators to figure out what happened and why. And, you know, the lack of an explanation was in some ways worse than the actual event. Is your ability to track this kind of thing better now than it was a year ago?
Well, you know, it did take us several months to be able to reconstruct on a second-by-second or microsecond-by-microsecond basis what happened on that day. And we did publish two very full reports that I think help people to understand exactly what happened. We have also proposed here at the SEC to have a consolidated audit trail system that would give us the tools to reconstruct trading after events like a May 6th much, much more quickly. We're not there yet, but I think we will get there and we will be able to give people complete answers a little bit more quickly in the future.
I think there is a sense that for the most part, people were not hurt by the flash crash because the markets did recover, as you pointed out. But, you know, we've heard from listeners who, for example, had stop loss orders in effect. So the system automatically sold during that period where stocks were dropping. And, you know, some of them ended up with, for example, huge tax bills this year because of that. Is the message to individual investors that they just have to factor in this kind of possibility into their risk tolerance?
I think investors were very profoundly impacted, and you know, 20,000 trades had to be canceled, and Many more investors sold at unreasonably low prices whose trades weren't canceled, and it clearly impacted investor confidence. My view of this is that investors should understand that when they buy and sell a stock, they take a risk in the investment value of that stock going up or down, and that's a risk they can understand and that they knowingly accept. My view is also, though, that they shouldn't have to accept the risk of frailty in the market structure, and that's why we've taken the steps we have.
How concerned are you about a lack of investor confidence in the system, given that something like this, in your own words, could happen again?
We continue to have in the United States the strongest and most robust capital markets in the world. But I worry about investor confidence every day because our economy won't grow. We won't create jobs if investors don't have confidence that they're both getting the information they need to make good investment decisions, but that the playing field on which they're transacting in stocks is one that provides them with access and fairness that's important to the integrity of their investment decisions.
Mary Shapiro is chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission. She has joined us from her office in Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So it's no surprise ordinary investors are having trouble trusting the market post-flash crash, but they're not the only ones who are disillusioned. Even professional investors, the folks who manage our retirement and college funds, are wondering if the market is rigged against them. You'd think these grizzled veterans would have seen it all, but the flash crash made them feel outnumbered and outgunned by a market where computers are just faster. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore has that side of the story.
Themis trading in New Jersey signals every stock trade with a distant blip. It sounds like the ping of underwater sonar. Since last year's flash crash, Sal Arnuck, the firm's co-founder, says he's in another kind of marine environment. He compares professional investors like him to guppies. Their profits are being devoured by much faster sharks, high-speed computer traders.
If you sit down at a table and you don't know who the patsy is, well, guess what? You're the patsy. Institutions have been the patsy.
Jim McHuggin is the CEO of Principal Global Investors, a big manager of mutual funds and 401ks. He said the flash crash was a psychological turning point for professional investors. It made them realize that the markets have become a game of man versus machine.
Institutional investors, some of them felt that the market was moving away from long-term allocation of savings towards more of a short-term betting mentality.
The fear isn't another flash crash, but the way high-speed computer trading can skew the market daily. The machines see the trades that professional investors are planning, the way only banks and exchanges once did. McHuggin warns that the high-speed computers often cut in line to get a better price. Michael Yoshikami, the founder of investment firm YCMNet Advisors, says the legions of computer programs can easily jolt the markets.
Institutional investors have strategies that we're employing, and we certainly don't want to derail just because a computer put in one extra zero.
Advocates of computer trading say that they're more rational, and humans still program them. Even so, the legacy of the flash crash is shaken confidence among professional traders. Sal Arnuck told clients this week that trading in today's markets was like this line from the movie Dirty Harry.
You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, stocks fell along with a sell-off in commodities. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers blasted another hole in a Missouri levee this afternoon. It was the second attempt this week to control the ever-swelling Mississippi River. Flooding already forced thousands of people out of their homes and destroyed valuable farmland, and the worst damage may still be a week or two and potentially hundreds of miles away. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
The Mississippi River continues to challenge flood records, racking up major losses.
One that we're acutely aware of is the damage to the farmland that was in the floodway and crops that those people have lost, and there were people with homes in there.
Jim Pogue from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers expects more damage as the river rolls south over the next few weeks. He says there are other, less obvious costs, like the money communities shell out as water heads their way.
Everything from extensive overtime for their employees, all of the equipment and materials that they need to fight their own battles.
It's just an ocean out there right now.
Jeff Huffman is the county executive in Tipton County, Tennessee, along the Mississippi.
We don't know what the costs are because the river is still rising, so a lot of the damage is underwater. We just can't see it yet.
Other costs are clearer. Some shipping channels have shut down. And then there's the issue of what happens when all that water, loaded with fertilizer from flooded fields, gets to the Gulf of Mexico. That fertilizer causes a dead zone where there's too little oxygen in the water. Don Bosch heads the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science.
If there's no oxygen on the bottom over very large areas, there's no fish and shrimp and shellfish and the like that can live there.
This flood will cause the dead zone to expand, an environmental cost that's hard to put a price tag on, and a predictable loss from a very unpredictable flood. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Damage of the man-made kind has descended on cities around the country since the housing bust. In many of them, you'll find block after blighted block of vacant homes. City halls have tried suing the big banks that made the subprime loans that led to all these foreclosures. Now Los Angeles is the latest entrant in the litigation game with a new approach. Instead of attacking lending practices, it's suing Deutsche Bank for, essentially, being the biggest slumlord in town. Marketplace's Janet Babin has that story.
The foreclosure crisis is known for all the dense, elaborate agreements made between various parties to shady mortgage loans. There's the lender, the servicer that collects the loan payments, and the trustee, to name just a few. Bankruptcy attorney Keith Maynard says all these players have made it tough for cities to prove which entity is responsible for faulty foreclosures.
It's really just a hard paper trail to follow to find out who owns that property, because a lot of times it's just an account number.
Los Angeles cut through that paper shuffle. It alleges that the owners of neglected foreclosed homes are the ones that should pay damages for the blight. Los Angeles Deputy City Attorney Julia Figuera McDonough says in hundreds of foreclosed homes in the city, that title owner is Deutsche Bank.
The buck stops with the owner. They're the owner. That's the end of the story. They have the obligations that any property owner would have under federal, state, and municipal law.
In a statement, Deutsche Bank said it's just the owner of record. It says by contract, loan servicers are responsible for maintaining foreclosed properties. University of Illinois law professor Robert Lawless says the city may have found a way to hold someone accountable for the boarded up homes nobody wants.
The city is alleging very specific statutory and code violations. And those violations, I think, put the city on a little bit better footing than some of the other cases we've seen.
If Los Angeles is successful, other towns will likely try a similar strategy. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Coming up, are college waiting lists getting too long?
It's a classic case of hedging your bets. But, yeah, twice the size of your freshman class? Come on. That's crazy.
But first, let's do the numbers. A sell-off in the commodities market helped push stocks lower today. The Dow lopped off 139 points, 0.1%, to end at 12,584. The Nasdaq lost 13 points, nearly 0.5%, to finish at 2814. And the S&P 500 parted with a dozen points, 0.9%, to close at 1335. Crude oil fell below $100 a barrel for the first time since mid-March. And pretty much every metal, precious or otherwise, fell too. We're talking copper, platinum, nickel, tin, lead, gold, and platinum. ExxonMobil spilled 2.5%. ConocoPhillips drained off 2.25%. The 10-year T-note gained, pushing the yield down to 3.15%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. And by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted mail. Reputation.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Farmers Insurance, trained agents committed to small business success. On the web at farmers.com.
Thank you.
If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues unemployment data for the month of April. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to report on consumer credit for March. And it's a day set aside to honor the families of our nation's armed forces. Tomorrow is Military Spouse Appreciation Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Back in March, the United States froze more than $30 billion worth of assets belonging to Colonel Muammar Gaddafi and his government. Today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the Obama administration wants to unfreeze some of those assets to, in her words, help the Libyan people. But as forces loyal to Gaddafi continue to hammer Libyan rebels, opposition leaders say they need more than just humanitarian aid and basic supplies. They need money for weapons and training. And that is something the U.S. and Europe don't seem willing to pay for. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
When Libyan rebels face Gaddafi's forces, it's hardly a fair fight. They've asked the NATO-led coalition for $2 to $3 billion for food and medicine and more military assistance, including weapons.
The coalition has been adamant about not wanting to go down that path of trying to arm the rebels as a way to topple Gaddafi, nor are they willing to put their own troops in on the ground.
That's Robert Dineen, a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He says they're worried about how much they'd have to spend and if it would even help the Libyan opposition.
Well, I think there's concern, first of all, that it takes time to stand up an army, train them, get them in a position where they're actually able to be effective.
Experts say it wouldn't be easy for the U.S. to control how the money would be spent. And Democratic Congressman Dennis Kucinich says it's illegal to redistribute those frozen Libyan billions.
It'll be dropped into that yawning pit of a war in which who knows where the money goes.
So far, the U.S. has pledged $53 million in humanitarian aid and $25 million in non-lethal military aid. Rebels aren't supposed to use that for weapons, but Kucinich says that's a joke.
Once you bring money, and money's fungible, and the money's going to inevitably end up arming individuals who have been members of groups which have fought the United States in the past.
But unfreezing Libyan assets could be a way to contribute more help without turning to U.S. taxpayers. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The Syrian regime has intensified its crackdown on protesters over the past week. Tanks are deployed across the country along with troops. Protests there broke out 6 weeks ago and are primarily about greater freedom and transparency. But as with elsewhere in the Arab world, there is a powerful economic dimension to the unrest. And in Syria, protesters are aiming their anger at one immensely wealthy and well-connected businessman. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
Among the slogans chanted by Syrian protesters has been this one: Makhlouf, you thief. The target of the protesters' wrath is a 41-year-old businessman, Rami Makhlouf. George Joffe is an expert on Arab affairs at Cambridge University.
He's a very big businessman indeed. In fact, he's said to be the most important businessman in Syria.
Joffe says the protesters are right to feel aggrieved. Makhlouf is not what you'd call a self-made man.
He's the first cousin to the president, Bashar al-Assad, and that puts him in an extremely privileged position.
Makhlouf has built up a huge business empire, milking his family connections to secure government contracts, licenses and land. His interests span telecoms, banking and duty-free shops. He accounts for some 60% of the public sector economy. Nabila Ramdani writes about the Arab world for The Guardian.
His fortune is very much based on corruption. There's no doubt about it. And no foreign company can do business in Syria without Makhlouf's approval and indeed involvement.
And that, says David Butter of the Economist Intelligence Unit, means a slice of the action for Makhlouf.
It's quite difficult to get anything done in the Syrian business scene
without Rami Makhlouf perhaps having a cut in your business.
Take the German car company Mercedes. Makhlouf was keen to win the contract to supply Mercedes spare parts in Syria. He didn't leave anything to chance, says George Joffe.
He was able to pass a law which made it obligatory for Mercedes to actually use his outlets rather than anyone else's.
Makhlouf is so entwined with the Assad regime that it's widely believed he's been involved in the crackdown. And that raises a question about the jewel in his corporate crown, his cell phone company. Syriatel has a 55% market share. Ironic, then, that some of the bloodiest and most damning images of the crackdown have been captured and relayed out of the country by cell phone. This use of the cell phone, says Nabila Ramdani, has posed a dilemma for the billionaire.
Makhlouf is first and foremost a businessman, so he does realise that if he bans completely, or if he shuts down completely the communication lines, then he will lose an awful lot of money.
Before the unrest, Makhlouf had been hailed as a symbol of Syria's economic progress. But, says George Joffe, he's now become a symbol of something else, which has fueled a lot of the protest in the Arab world.
It's not just a question of political freedoms. It's that those elites who rule are simply exploiting the commonwealth for their own personal benefits, thereby denying people access to jobs and access to reasonable living standards too.
Marketplace contacted Rami Makhlouf requesting a comment. The businessman did not respond. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This week marked the deadline for students to decide which college got the thumbs up from them. Throughout most of the college application process, the students do the wooing and the waiting, but now it is their turn to be the decider. Plunk down a few $100 to reserve a spot, make the travel arrangements, and start planning the dorm room decor. That is, unless you're on a waiting list. Colleges that get too few yeses are now looking to those wait lists to make sure the numbers add up. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
A few weeks ago, Javier Acevedo sent $800 to George Washington University in D.C. to reserve his spot in the class of 2015. But when I called him in Puerto Rico this week, he was still holding out some hope for Johns Hopkins. He's on the wait list there.
It's almost like being in a state of purgatory. You're not in, you're not out. It's pretty strange.
So do you have any idea how many other students are on the wait list at Hopkins?
I would imagine the number is very large.
Try 2,700 for a class of just over 1,200. I stopped by campus the other day to find out why. Outside the Hopkins admissions office, a banner welcomes admitted students. Almost 20,000 people applied for those coveted spots this year, a record. John Ladding is the university's dean of undergraduate admissions. While wait lists keep getting longer at many colleges, he says this year's list is actually smaller than last year's, by about 1,000 students.
We're trying to be as fair as possible and as transparent and really not needlessly raise expectations of people.
Still, the Hopkins waitlist is more than twice the size of the freshman class. And last year, of more than 3,000 on that list, only 32 got in.
And there are years where we might need 150, 170. There are years when we literally don't admit a single person off the waitlist.
The thing is, Ladding has a tough job. If he doesn't fill enough seats, that's lost revenue for the university. If he fills too many, it means overcrowded classrooms and dorms. Yet he never knows if the students he accepts will accept Hopkins. Barmak Nasirian is with the American Association of Collegiate Registrars and Admissions Officers. He says students apply to so many colleges these days, it's harder for people like Ladding to judge how serious they are. Technology and the rise of the common application have made it easy to apply to a handful of schools with a few mouse clicks.
The waitlist becomes a device by which you
you can sort of attempt to control that, that if you play it conservative and if you come in under, you can always have a second bite of the apple. That's the notion.
It's a classic case of hedging your bets. But, yeah, twice the size of your freshman class? Come on. That's crazy.
Allie Mendelson is an education consultant. She helps kids navigate the college search. She says long wait lists are cruel to students. Two of her clients are on wait lists this year. She tells them not to take it personally.
It might be that you had a wonderful SATs, fabulous recommendation, the best essay. And it might be that what they really need is a math major who plays the oboe and comes from Arkansas. And you just can't be that person.
And that's why Johns Hopkins' waitlist is 2,700 instead of 300. Admissions Dean John Ladding says he has to look at the class so far and see where the gaps are.
We're forming a community of people, and we have many constituencies around the university that we serve. So we need to keep our options open because we just don't know what kind of student we're going to be needing.
If it turns out they need an international studies major from Puerto Rico, Javier Acevedo may be in luck. But he says at times he thinks a flat no would have been better than a long shot maybe. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering business owners financial guidance for the long term. Information at massmutual.com. By Manta, connecting millions of small business owners with new customers every day. On the web at manta.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note.
Ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll.
If you're as old as I am, it feels like MTV has been around forever. It's had staying power, that's for sure, from the VJ era to SpongeBob and the Jersey Shore. Its current CEO has had similar staying power. Judy McGrath started working at MTV in 1981, the year it launched. She was a copywriter. Today, the network announced her resignation, but it didn't give a reason. It said the CEO position would be eliminated. Here's hoping Pauly, Snooki, and the gang take her out for some going-away drinks. You know, if she wants that.
I want my MTV. All right.
I want my MTV.
And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lopped off 139 points, 1.1%. The Nasdaq lost 13 points, nearly half of 1%. And the S&P 500 parted with a dozen points, 0.9%. Our editors include Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, creating a healthier potato chip that still tastes good.
When we design crystal salt, you actually taste more in your tongue, so you can use less, and it gives you a more salty flavor.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.